Wages. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Andrew McRoberts. I'm with Sands Anderson. I'm here on behalf of James City County, also the James River Association, and also a trust of James City County and other property owners called the James River Trust, Save the James Alliance Trust. Thank you. We're here because my clients collectively wish to protect the interests of the Commonwealth and their own interests and their citizens' interests, their members' interests, and the members of the trust as well, against this intrusion into what is now a quite pristine area of Virginia. In some ways, it's quite unique. It's evocative, as the evidence showed, of the original settlers coming through this area on their way to Jamestown. It's part of a National Historic Water Trail, the John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail. It is directly adjacent to areas of national significance like Carter's Grove, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. It's directly within view over unobstructed open water from the Colonial Parkway, from one of the most beautiful places on the Colonial Parkway, where you come around a bend and there's a beach, and there is unbroken views that are the same as when John Smith and the settlers arrived. It's also within view of Jamestown Island from Black's Point. There is a parking area, there is a trail, it is beautiful. You go there and you look out on the very same view that the Indians and John Smith viewed back in those days across Hogs Island. What is proposed is a project that has towers as tall as the Statue of Liberty, not just one of them, but four of them. It has dozens of other towers that are not at that tall, but they're quite tall. Because the construction is nearby to not only open water, but also an airfield at the nearby Fort Eustis, it's required to have lights. It'll be blinking lights during the day. It'll be solid red lights at night. It's going to have large colored balls on the wires. It's going to be something that's plainly visible from a number of significant, important historic sites across the historic triangle. And because of that, my clients have set forth significant resources in a down economy to come in and oppose this. We have three assignments of error.
Before you get to your argument,
yes, sir.
Can you talk about the motion to dismiss? I'm particularly concerned about the failure to file a notice of appeal and the impact of that under Rule 5:21.
The motion to dismiss suggests that we somehow have not filed a notice of appeal that we're somehow required to. As we stated in our original brief and in more detail in our reply brief, Rule 5:21 controls this. It supersedes all the other rules, and so none of the other rules apply. You need to solely look to 5:21 for the answer to the motion to dismiss. 5:21A2 provides that all parties below in the SEC are parties on appeal, but, quote, may thereafter be limited as hereinafter provided, period, unquote. Nothing in 5:21 thereafter limits James City County's participation or any of my other clients' participation. And Dominion has cited nothing in the rule that does. Also, this court's construction of 5:21 has been held to necessarily be liberal, to allow all parties in interest to be heard. There's nothing in 5:21 that requires that every single party below file a notice of appeal. In fact, A2 specifically recognizes that that's not going to happen, that all parties below are parties on that appeal. Once a notice of appeal from a party is filed, that gives this court jurisdiction. And thereafter, only parties that fail to file a notice of participation or thereafter fail to file a brief would then no longer be parties. That's our position, Judge, and we believe, Your Honor, and we think it specifically is held out by the language in 5:21. which supersedes all the other rules. And all of Dominion's authorities and arguments and analogies are to other rules that have nothing to do with this case.
Well, it is. It's not the other rules that they refer to do not directly control. They bring it up as an analogous comparison.
So, well, they argue an analogy, but none of them are from by right appeals like this one, where a notice appeal from a party under A2 creates an appeal that all parties are party to, and then they are somehow limited, and then they're classified thereafter in 521. But there's nothing in 521 that says every single party has to file a notice of appeal. And in fact, most have not. As a matter of fact, BSF has not.
The rule itself in subsection 6 has some interesting language, and I think you need to address it. Right in the middle of subsection 6, it says, every party who seeks reversal or modification of the order appealed from shall be deemed an appellant, and every party who seeks affirmance of the order appealed from shall be deemed an appellee. Why is the word deemed in there?
Because
why shouldn't it just say shall be an appellant?
That's because at the point that there is a notice of appeal filed by a party, all parties are then subject to party to the appeal. Then they classify themselves thereafter under A6. A6 provides that parties in appeal who did not file a notice of appeal, like James City County and the others, who didn't file a notice of appeal, can then file a notice of participation and designate and say, I'm a party appellant or I'm a party appellee.
Well, as you well know, in matters that aren't involving the State Corporation Commission, if someone files a notice of appeal, they're in the case. If they file cross error, they're only in the case to the extent that the appeal remains. And so that's what their analogy is that under subsection 6, if you were supposed to be in that case, the language would not have been deemed an appellant. It would have been shall be an appellant, in order to defeat the concept that the lack of a notice of appeal or the withdrawal of a notice of appeal basically causes the notice of participation to fall. And I suspect it's a very important issue here in this case, because James City County has some interesting questions.
Well, and we suggest that the fact that 521 supersedes all those other rules means that, you know, with all due respect, I understand the analogy they're trying to make, but it's simply inapplicable.
Well,
it's about...
Sorry. We already crossed that. It doesn't apply. It's an analogy. There's a difference.
I understand. It's an analogy, and we disagree with the analogy, because under those cases, it's not a by right appeal. And what happens is there has to be the assignment of this cross error in order for the court to apply it. That's not true here. What is true here is a notice of appeal creates a case with everybody. And then thereafter, whether they file the notice or not, file a notice of participation. And so we believe that while the analogy I see where they're headed, we don't believe it applies because of the unique way that 521 applies. At this time, I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
The thing I would like to focus the most on today are the arguments.
You're going to reserve 8 minutes. I see.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
First is the interpretation of 56-46.1F, and this is the preemption of local zoning. As you know, the General Assembly from time to time has determined that local zoning should be preempted for various reasons. When that happens, this court has held that it has to be manifest and clear. And that makes sense because zoning is there to protect the health, safety, welfare of the citizens of the Commonwealth through the political subdivisions of the state. And so it's a very critical power that be preserved if at all possible. In this case, subsection F of the statute says that where there is a transmission line being applied for in a certificate, the transmission line is not subject to local zoning. It doesn't say anything about other things that could be applied for in a certificate, such as substations, in this case a 51-acre switching station, power plants, or other types of facilities that are not part of a transmission line. In our view, that given the presumption against zoning preemption, and the need for clear and manifest intent, that manifest intent is not there. In fact, we would argue the opposite. That is very clear that they don't intend to preempt things like switching stations, substations, and other plants and facilities that are not part of a transmission line. We cited to the court the definition of a transmission line in Webster's Third New International Dictionary. I would supplement that verbally by suggesting that this is closer to the definition of a substation, which is also found in that same dictionary. And that definition calls it a station subsidiary to a central station, and at which high-tension electricity from the central station is transformed to electricity lower in potential and converted, if desired, to continuous current or alternating current of a different frequency. That goes to the purpose and intent and, in fact, effect of what a switching station does. It takes power and voltages from a certain level, and it changes it to another. And then it takes it from one line, hands it off to another. That's exactly what's intended there. So, supporting the plain meaning of the statute, we submit the dictionaries, but we also submit the plain and common usage, not just by the engineers that testified, but also by Dominion, and in fact by the commission itself. The county's expert Whittier said the transmission line moves power from one place to another, which is logical, but a switching station converts power from one voltage to the other. The State Corporation Commission staff expert said that a switching station is a bulk electric system facility, and he said specifically he wouldn't characterize the Skiff's Creek station as a line. In fact, the NERC definition, which was cited below by Dominion and on appeal by the SEC staff, says that these things operate at high voltages, these transmission lines, and, quote, are capable of transmitting large quantities of electricity over long distances. That's consistent with Mr. Whittier's and the SEC staff's expert and the dictionary as well. But let me talk for a minute about Dominion's common usage and the Commission's common usage. This is the first time that they have taken this position, that local zoning is somehow preempted by over things like substations and switching stations. It's the first time they've taken this
position. Does FERC have any jurisdiction over a switching station?
I beg your pardon?
Does FERC have any jurisdiction over a switching station?
I believe that they've already determined sort of reliability and need and things like that before the certificate process.
But do they have jurisdiction if they were to choose to get involved with regard to a switching
station? I think that's already been resolved, Justice Mills.
I understand. They have jurisdiction. Not is it a question in this case. Do they have jurisdiction over a switching station?
I believe that, well, and so does the SEC from that perspective. I mean, certainly as to the need and the reliability and whether the power works, those kinds of things are certainly reviewed by them. We're not contesting that the Commission or FERC has jurisdiction in a certificate process to review the Skiff's Creek station.
FERC,
that's not the
FERC
question.
FERC has jurisdiction over transmission, does it not?
It is transmission over all of the electric power facilities under 56-46.1A.
FERC does not have jurisdiction over generation, for example, does it?
It's outside the case, Justice Mims. I really don't know.
I'm asking for legal principles. FERC has jurisdiction over transmission generally. Is that's my pending question. Is that correct?
I don't know, Justice Mims. Dominion in their application asked for specifically, and if you look at on their cover letter and their cover of their application, and everywhere throughout, they named two transmission lines, a 500 kV Surrey to Skiff's Creek transmission line, a 230 Skiff's Creek to Wilton transmission line, and then a third public utility facility, the Skiff's Creek switching station. So they themselves have used this as not a transmission line, otherwise they would have called it that. It's a switching station. Past zoning cases, there was testimony from Dominion's own representative that they have repeatedly, as many as 50 times in the career of company witness Harper, have applied for zoning for this type of facility. Even in the Fauquier County case that Dominion likes to cite, they like to wave that around, and I'll discuss that case in just a moment. Even in that case, they applied for local zoning approval. The fact is, Dominion has never taken this position before, and company witness Harper admitted, no, we're just taking this position for this project. In fact, Dominion acknowledged the need for local zoning approval in a very similar project, the Greenway substation case in Loudoun County. In that case, they acknowledged the need for Loudoun County zoning approval, and they also specifically agreed to have the condition that local zoning be complied with before the certificate would be valid. In fact, let's talk about the SEC's common uses. That's a good example. The Commission has acknowledged the fact that there is a need for local zoning approval in the past, in that case and others. And in this case, and also in the SEC guidelines of minimum requirements for transmission line applications filed under Virginia Code 56-46.1 and the Utility Facilities Act, it says that designs and exteriors of substations and facilities should comport with surroundings and buildings and et cetera, all in keeping with local control and local zoning ordinance. If, in fact, they take the position that these kinds of facilities are not subject to local zoning, why would they have that in their guidelines? And lastly, we believe this is really controlled by, since we're talking about plain meaning and common application, it's controlled by common sense. The fact is, nobody would think that a bulk electric facility or a switching station is a transmission line. It simply is not. It's not a line. It doesn't go from place to place. It violates basic geometry. And in fact, it's supported by this court's decision in Board of Supervisors versus Fairfax, Fairfax County versus BEPCO. In that case, Dominion likes to cite this, and the SEC likes to cite this for its principle that under 56-46.1, that this regulation is important because we have to have statewide control. But what they don't quote to the court, and they want to ignore, is the rest of that sentence. It says that the zoning preemption of 46.1 specifically, quote, takes into account the practicality that such transmission lines often traverse several counties. I use the word transmission just to make it clear. In addition, the statutory interpretation rules favor the county. First of all, as I said before, the commission has applied this uniformly for years. Dominion has agreed to have zoning control for years of local government over these identical facilities. And the General Assembly has taken no action to amend 56-46.1F to make it broader or to use a broader term like electric utility facilities that are necessary for transmission or anything. The General Assembly could have done that, and they chose not to. And that's a rule of statutory construction of this court. The second is expressio unius est exclusio alterius. I'm not a Latin scholar, so I'll leave it to you to see whether I pronounce that correctly, but I'm very excited to be standing in this room to be able to say it. But it basically means that, you know, when you say something in one, the General Assembly puts something in one part and they say something different in another part, it means that they meant there's some difference. If you rule with the SEC and the Dominion on this issue, there is no difference between a public electrical utility facility under subsection A and subsection B and F that use the word transmission line. It means basically all the utility facilities that are subject to certificate, and certainly the General Assembly did not intend that. The third rule of interpretation that's violated by the Commission is in para materia, and the fact that the two terms we're talking about, public utility facilities and transmission line, are used consistently throughout not only this statute, but also 56-265.2, 265.1:1, 15.2-223, and 15.2-2232, and that's discussed thoroughly in our brief. But I want to focus specifically on 56-265.1:1, which actually prohibits local governments. So General Assembly, you know, does know how to limit local government power. Prohibits localities from expanding, quote, electric utility facilities, essentially the same term under subsection A, without a certificate. And so the General Assembly knows how to exclude local government power using broader terms. They've chosen not to here. And lastly, on the interpretation, we believe that the SEC's interpretation results in absurd things. Like there's information required under subsection B, such as like the map of the route, information on undergrounding of the line, things like that, that they have to be required to publish a corridor to those parties within the corridor. Well, we're not talking about a corridor here. We're talking about a 51-acre parcel in James City County that Dominion owns. So these kinds of things would have no application whatsoever if you deemed to have a 51-acre switching station property somehow exempt from local government control. As we pointed out in our brief, this issue was addressed in the last constitutional debates. There was concern that zoning could be somehow inconsistent with commission action on electrical facilities, and it was deemed to leave that in the hands of the General Assembly and not to take action on that.
You'd want to reserve 8 minutes. You're down to less than six. You may use your time any way you'd like.
Okay, I just had a clarification. I thought the 8 minutes had been deducted already. Has not? It has not. Okay. Then I will go quickly to the legal issue. on the interpretation. And I would concur with BAS counsel on that point. I believe that the commission has interpreted 56-46.1, particularly subsection B, incorrectly. In that, the commission talked about how the need was so great it outweighed, you know, the other needs. The hearing examiner specifically said the commission should find that the line is needed, then the commission determine which route minimizes impacts. That is a hearing examiner recommendation which they complied with. The commission, in its order at page 35, said, based on the record, the commission finds the impediments associated with attempting to address these reliability violations by placing a transmission line underground outweighs competing environmental consideration. There's nothing in the statute that where need is weighed against minimization. Minimization is an independent requirement. In fact, in the language of the statute, it's a prerequisite. It says, as a condition to approval of the certificate, there must be reasonable minimization. And the point I want to make on oral argument, since I'm running out of time on this, is that reasonable minimization works both ways. Dominion likes to talk about how, well, we can't possibly minimize it over this river. It's the best we can do. That's not the standard. The standard is minimization, which means to the least degree possible. And I know the word is reasonable there, but it cuts both ways. It actually has to minimize the impact. In this case, it doesn't, reasonably or otherwise. And so, therefore, we believe that they have significantly sort of merged the need and the other aspect on this. I promised I would address the Fauquier County case. In Fauquier County case, if you read the order, the Fauquier County judge never mentioned zoning or preemption. It's just simply not mentioned. And as you know, a circuit judge speaks through his orders. They've said that that's what the order says, but it doesn't. And lastly, the Maine case is under Maine law. It's based upon whether a utility company ought to stay in the case or not and whether it should be covered by certificate or not. And really has nothing to do with this case. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
3 minutes and 13 seconds.
Yep. May it please the court, again, I'm John Dudley with the State Corporation Commission. I'm again sharing time with Dominion. The Commission considered all of the alternatives in this case, including those proposed by James City County. Again, the Commission found that an overhead 500 kilovolt line needs to be built into Northampton Roads. If it's not, there will be severe reliability violations. Those violations could result in outages throughout all of Northampton Roads. As I noted, those outages could cascade into Richmond, Northern Virginia, and down into North Carolina. Yes, the Commission focused on the need. That's what the Commission is required to do under the statute. The Commission has to find two things. One, that the line is needed. Then second, that the route will reasonably minimize adverse impacts. The Commission did both of those. It did both of those separately. The evidence in this case supports the Commission's finding that the overhead 500 kilovolt line into Northampton Roads is needed. No error has been assigned to that finding. So we're left with, in this case, generally three issues. The first is procedural, Dominion's motion to dismiss. Then the next two are the route and the switching station. And I'm going to start with the route. The Commission separately, independently, and explicitly found that the river crossing will reasonably minimize adverse impacts. Again, that doesn't mean that a transmission line will have no impact. That would not be possible, so that's not what the statute requires. The statute requires the Commission to find that the route reasonably minimizes that impact. And again, the Commission explicitly made that finding for the river crossing, and we, starting at page 24 of our brief, cite all the places in the Commission's November order we made that finding. That finding is supported by the evidence, and the Commission explained in the brief and in the order some of the evidence relied upon. Some of that evidence includes that the river crossing will be in an area that's already heavily impacted by development. That development includes things like the Surrey Nuclear Power Station, water towers, a sewage treatment plant, the ghost fleet, military installations, a marina, a resort, industrial sites, a jail, and tall theme park rides. Also, the evidence showed that part of the river crossing will be screened by Hog Island, and the river crossing will not be visible from Colonial Williamsburg or from Yorktown. It also will not be visible from the fort, the settlement, the visitor center, or the archaeological digs at Jamestown Island. So when we're looking at the route, the commission did the two things required by statute. My final two points to close on the route. First, the commission explicitly complied with the statutory requirement and found that the river crossing reasonably minimizes adverse impacts. And second, there's evidence in this record to support that finding. And that gets me to the third and final, the switching station. The commission found that the transmission switching station is an inseparable part of the transmission lines in this case, so therefore the commission included the switching station as part of the transmission line certificates. That was the commission's obligation under the statute. The commission has to determine whether or not to grant a transmission line certificate, and when it grants a transmission line certificate, determine what to include and not to include as part of that certificate. The applicant in this case asked the commission to include the switching station, and so the commission did an analysis whether or not to grant or deny that request.
So let me interrupt you just a second. It just seems to me to be sort of common sense that the zoning implications of a transmission line that's going to go along a corridor are going to be different from the zoning implications of a switching station that may cover 50 acres of land.
Well, and that's why we noted in our brief that James City County's assignment of error is incorrect. They assigned error to the commission's finding that the county is preempted. The commission did not make a preemption finding. And we point that out in our brief. There was no preemption finding in the commission's order. The commission did what was required to under the statute, made a factual finding as to whether or not the switching station should or should not be part of the transmission line and the transmission line certificates, and then the preemption happens by operation of law under 46, still the same title, 56, but under 46.1F. And on reply, James City County, I believe, admits that they assigned error to the result, what they call the result of the commission's ruling and not the actual commission ruling. And in reply, they're actually asking you not to reverse a preemption ruling by the commission, which their assignment of error says. They're asking you to reverse the commission's factual finding. So that's how the commission, and that's how I'm going to explain it, that it was okay, we have a question in front of us, do we include this particular switching station as part of these transmission lines in this case? Well, and under this statute, and you know, first thing, the plain language, look at the statute, and then we have a question of law, then a question of fact. Under this statute, electrical transmission lines are not limited to just the wires. There's not a definition inside the statute that does that, and there's not a definition outside the statute that does that. Under the industry and the dictionary definitions that were used in this case, and we include the industry because these lines are being built to satisfy NERC industry standards, so the commission considered the industry definition as like you consider black law for a legal term or Gray's Anatomy for a medical term, but under both the industry and the dictionary definitions, in this case, a transmission line is more than just wires. Those definitions say that transmission line is a circuit. It's made up of metallic conductors and structures that are needed to carry the high-voltage electricity. So if we're looking at plain meaning, the first question of fact, there is not an ordinary definition when we look at the dictionary and the industry definitions that limits transmission lines to just wires. It is the circuit, metallic conductors. Now, a wire is one of the metallic conductors, but it's not the only metallic conductors or structures that make up the transmission line. So that's when it turns into a question of fact, and the commission has to apply the facts of whatever component we're looking at, and this time the component's the switching station, and do those facts fit in to this ordinary definition of transmission line? The commission found that it did. The switching station is physically made up of metallic conductors and structures that transmit the high-voltage electricity. Also, the switching station is needed to create the transmission circuit. You don't have a circuit without it. The switching station is also part of the transmission line corridor. It was explicitly noticed as part of the route in this proceeding. The switching station is an electrically inseparable part of the transmission lines, which can't function without it. Council mentioned one of the witnesses for staff said that he didn't think the line was a station. obviously the commission is not bound by its staff or one witness. I also mentioned that that same witness had testimony that supports the commission's decision. That same witness, I think he used the word agnostic, saying when you're doing the power flow analysis to determine if this new transmission line serves the reliability need, that those analyses are agnostic as to whether electricity, high voltage electricity, is flowing over something called a line or a station. And it still ties into Justice Mims' question. Yes, this is under FERC jurisdiction. We pointed out in our brief that as part of the FERC PJM planning process, when they're planning to meet these transmission needs, the switching station is part of that process. And we included that in the site in our brief. So the switching station is part of the transmission line process that's regulated by FERC and by designation PJM. And that's why we also mentioned that the only other state commission that looked at this, the Maine Commission, reached the same conclusion. And I believe the Maine Commission is squarely on point to the extent that the Maine Commission made a factual decision. They had to decide whether or not to include a transmission switching station as part of a transmission line certificate. They weren't looking at preemption. Well, the commission, preemption happens by operation of law. The commission was making a factual determination. Is this switching station actually part of a transmission line, so it should be included in a certificate? The Maine Commission reached the same conclusion that the Virginia Commission did. But I want to emphasize that that doesn't mean that anything can be part of a transmission line. Just the opposite. There has to be a factual basis. And that's why we cited the Bowmead Greenway case in our brief. And that's a commission case where the commission did look at this question. But in that case, it wasn't a transmission switching station. It was a distribution station. And in that case, the commission found that the distribution station was not part of the transmission line because the distribution station was not needed to carry the high voltage electricity. Rather, the distribution station was needed to take the high voltage electricity, put it into low voltage, and send it out to end-use customers. In that instance, the commission said that the distribution station was not part of the transmission line and therefore required local approval. But the point is that, like here, that was a factual decision that the commission had to make under the statute. And I think I've covered my response to the questions that were asked earlier. So to close on the switching station, again, I'll reiterate that there are two points. That the statute doesn't limit transmission line to just the wires. Transmission line is the circuit. The entire circuit may have metallic conductors and structures that are needed to carry the high voltage electricity. And the evidence in this record supports the commission's finding that the switching station in this proceeding is an inseparable part of these transmission lines. And if there are no questions, I'll yield to the venue.
May I ask a procedural question?
Yes.
On the motion to dismiss, as counsel for James City County indicated, this is a unique provision. And it's difficult to find another provision like it, if at all, in the Virginia Code. And then if you look at the Constitution, Section 4, on appeals from actions of the Commission, it's obviously very, very broad. And the plain language of A3 doesn't require multiple notices of appeal. And then if you look at a non-suit, let's think about that for an analogy for a second. If you think about a non-suit situation, it supports James City County's theory of the case on the motion to dismiss. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, we had mentioned, I believe, in our brief, the motion to dismiss is the relevant to James. There are three orders on appeal here, and we point out that if the motion to dismiss is granted, the appeal of the November order goes away and takes with it all of James City County's assignments of error. So that's James City County appeal goes away. The commission that's in the record, the commission's practice has been, Your Honor, that in order for a party to get in front of this court, to have an appeal heard by this court, a notice of appeal had to be filed. That's the key to get here. That's been the commission's practice. For example, if a notice of appeal was filed and our clerk's office was told by the person who filed the notice of appeal, we're not going forward, the clerk didn't send over the record. Or we're not We're withdrawing it. We're not filing a petition for appeal. That's why the clerk's office in this proceeding actually sent a letter to the course clerk saying, we have one notice of appeal. We've been informed that that appeal is not going forward. We're not sending over the record. But if you want it, please tell us and we'll send it over immediately. But that was consistent with the commission's view that even though it's a unique statute or a unique section of the rules, there's still just one thing. You file a notice of appeal. Anybody who wants to preserve their right to appeal a commission decision has it's an appeal by right. All they have to do is file the notice. And so the commission's view has been if that notice is the key, not just me, to get in the door. Unless you are holding the notice, you don't get in the door. So that has been the commission's practice.
Mr. Dudley, you've been at the commission for a long time. Are you aware of any other case where a notice to participate but not a notice of appeal was filed and it was denied on that basis?
A notice of participate.
Yeah, that's
but
what
no
happened.
Notice of appeal? For,
but there's a notice of participation.
No. There.
This is the first case that
this,
you know.
This is the first case where...
Right.
Well, we've had parties file notices of appeal right. And then say we're not going to go forward with it or the petition for appeal not to be filed, but we haven't had a party who... Dominion's notice came in on day 30, and then after that, the parties who said they wanted to be part of the case filed their intent to participate after the deadline for notice of appeal. But being aware that even though Dominion's withdrawing it, we may have two parties that might want to go forward. That's why we sent the letter to the court's clerk, thinking of the case. The parties who had filed the notice of intent may want to go forward. We have never seen that happen. A party who had just filed a notice of intent to participate be able to go forward just with that notice of intent. I'm not aware of that ever happened.
All right.
Are you aware of the commission having dismissed their notice of intent to appeal once the notice of appeal was withdrawn?
Once we issue the final order, being appealed from, the commission doesn't issue anything subsequently. Either we send the record over to the court or we don't. The parties sometimes continue to speak to the commission. They have to file the notice of appeal with us, but we don't do anything in response. They have to file a notice of intent to participate with us. Even if the person who filed a notice of appeal says, I'm not going forward, the commission wouldn't issue an order dismissing the notice of appeal. It just dies under its own lack of...
I guess the reason why I ask is I wonder under this unique rule, if it's a fail-safe, the party waits and says, well, if there's not going to be an appeal at all, fine. I'm not going to file a notice of appeal and start this process myself. Somebody else does, I'll file a notice of participation.
But we didn't brief this, but I would argue that it's not a fail-safe, that the notice of intent to participate means I'm a party, I'm okay with the commission's order, but somebody else, this is a legislative proceeding, right? There are many, many parties, not just A versus B. It's a protection in case I'm okay with the commission's order, but somebody else wants to change it.
Sure.
Wait a second, I like what they did.
Yeah,
it is a fail-safe.
They don't want any changes without them being up here, right?
Right. But it's protect against, it's still that first notice of appeal is what's needed to get here. If you don't have that first notice of appeal, then there's nothing for the...
I understand your argument. It is unusual language, so, and I must admit, it's our rule.
And the next sentence says that once that happens, they're deemed an appellant and an appellee, one or the other, right?
Deemed, yes.
Right.
Obviously, I'm going to go back to the question. Right. Deemed, but it doesn't. It's
so you can deemed. Be deemed an appellant even though you haven't filed an appeal.
Even though you haven't filed the notice, that's
yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
In fact, we have that quite often in front of the court.
Well, but doesn't that in and of itself demonstrate that the notice of participation makes you an appellant or an appellee?
And that's a party.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
right.
I just need to explain the way the commission has practiced, applied it in the past. It makes you a party to the case that was filed by the with the notice of appeal. That's the appeal. Somebody files a notice of appeal, that's the case. You're a party to that case. It doesn't stand instead of you filing your own notice of appeal. Again, that's been the commission's practice, and that's why we sent a letter over in case the court wanted the record.
So your position is that they're deemed a party, and once the person who files the notice withdraws, they are no longer deemed a party?
Your Honor, I'm stepping a little bit outside. You see, this was Dominion's motion, and the commission sort of explained the outcome of it and what we had done in the past.
Okay.
We didn't object to their motion, but that's how we had practiced. That's been our practice in the past, because until that petition for appeal is filed by the person who filed the notice of appeal, there's nothing at the court. The court doesn't
but
have.
But once it is filed, there is something in the court. Is it possible that our rule just doesn't address what happens when you have parties deemed parties by virtue of the fact that they file their intent to participate, and the person who files the notice of appeal drops out? Perhaps the rule just doesn't address that situation.
So Thomas mentioned it was the court's rule, and we want to sort of explain how we've applied it, not how you should apply it. But our practice has been, though, that filing that notice to participate doesn't put you in the shoes of having filed a notice of appeal. Those are two different documents, and all you have to do to preserve your right to appeal is file the notice.
All right. Thank you. You have encroached. Stop the clock. You have encroached upon his time. I'm going to give you two more minutes, and I'm going to add two more minutes to your case as well. All right? Go ahead. So you have add two more minutes to the clock for Dominion, and we'll add 2 minutes to James City County for rebuttal.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Again, Your Honors, I'm Joe Reed from McGuire Woods on behalf of the Appalachian Virginia Electric and Power Company. And since we're on the subject of the procedural issue associated with Dominion's motion to dismiss, I'll begin there. And quite simply, Your Honors, the 30-day requirement to file a notice of appeal is jurisdictional. It's jurisdictional both in the circuit courts of the Commonwealth, and it's jurisdictional with respect to appeals from the State Corporation Commission. Under Rule 5:21, if a party does not file a notice of appeal, while it may participate in an appeal noticed by another party and argue for upholding or reversing the commission's order on appeal on the points raised by the noticed party, it can do that, but it may not independently raise grounds for appeal which it could have raised had it appealed the order itself.
And where does the rule say that? Where does the rule say they cannot independently raise an issue? That was, but when I read it at first, I thought they're limited to that. But they don't have to even make their assignments of error until paragraph 9, which is well after this whole process has started.
That's true, Your Honor, that it's not explicitly addressed in the language of the rule, but the company would take the position that the purpose of the rule of 521 is that if you have an issue that you want to raise independently on appeal, then you have a burden to file a notice of appeal within 30 days, and not simply to lay in wait, and if another party files a notice of appeal, create, you know, a free-for-all for raising any issue among all parties.
But you don't even know what the issues are until within 10 days after the issuance by the clerk of the certificate. And so the notice of appeal has been filed, the notice to participate has been filed, parties have been designated as appellees or appellants, and then you identify the issues. So it's not as if the notice of appeal sets up what the issue is.
That's true under the procedural sequence, Justice Powell, but again, we believe that the purpose of the rule is that if a party has an issue that they want to raise on appeal, and let's take this case, for example, where James City County has raised this question of whether the switching station is part of a transmission line under 46.1F. Obviously, Dominion agrees with the Commission's determination on that issue and would not have raised that issue pursuant to its notice of appeal. If James City County wanted to raise that issue on appeal. It knew that it wanted to raise that issue on appeal when the commission issued its order, or should have known when the commission issued its order on November 26th of 2013.
Did James
it should
City
have filed a timely filed
did
notice
Did James
of
City County identify that as an appellate issue before or after Dominion withdrew its notice of appeal?
After.
Okay. What else was raised after? Is that the only issue that's before us?
Well, I believe that James City County did not file its petition for appeal until after Dominion had indicated that it would not file a petition for appeal.
Okay. But I understand. That is correct. Did James City County in any way identify the issues that are now in its petition for appeal through its notice of participation or any other documentation that came prior to Dominion withdrawing its notice of appeal?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
When Dominion filed its notice for appeal, am I correct that the commission had not amended its order?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so how could James City County have filed a notice of appeal? Had the 30 days run?
Yes, the 30 days.
So how could James City County have filed its notice of appeal identifying the switch from 4.1 to 1 as an issue when it hadn't occurred?
I think we need to make sure, Justice Powell, that we're not conflating the parties. BASF did file a notice of appeal in a timely fashion from the order amending certificates in February of 2014, Dominion is not taking the position that was in any way untimely.
Thank you.
Clearly, their issue has to do with the order amending certificates, and they timely filed a notice of appeal and a petition for appeal.
Counsel, I think what you're trying to say maybe is that the way that James City County argues it, they'd actually have 51 days rather than 30 days to decide that they wanted to appeal this issue.
I think that's exactly right, Justice Millett. And to draw an analogy, the company's interpretation of the rule is just as in the circuit courts of the Commonwealth. The noticing party or parties is essentially in the driver's seat of the appeal. And while under the State Corporation Commission's protocols, where we do have multiple parties typically in these proceedings, other parties can jump in the car if they desire and sound in one way or the other on the issues of appeal. But if the driver gets out of the car, the appeal is over and the passengers aren't left to drive it wherever they want to drive it.
I think all of us would agree this rule is troublesome. But isn't the history of hearings before the commission that they hear everybody who's affected by what they're going to do? And should not this rule at least be tempered with some of that historical thinking?
Well, two comments. One, I do note that 5:21 is called a special rule, and we don't disagree that it is a special rule. I don't disagree either, Justice Kuntz, that the commission has a very lenient standard for participation in proceedings. However, the rules governing appeals, as I began with, are jurisdictional, and historically this court has looked at those with a very close eye when parties don't properly follow the appeal procedures. And perhaps, Justice McClanahan, that's a distinction between the non-suit situation under Code Section 8.01380, where a party who wants to exercise a voluntary non-suit can't do so unless there's a cross-claim or counterclaim pending. That's in the trial context. This is in the appellate context.
Well, counsel, I want to go back to my question. This is not like the ordinary civil case where one side or the other doesn't file their notice of appeal. In the sense of the commission is concerned about anybody affected by their ruling, it's just a different kind of proceeding, isn't it?
I don't disagree with you, Justice Kuntz, except that once the commission has issued its order, then their jurisdiction ceases and we're under the jurisdiction of this court and the rules of this court. and the determinations of this court. It's the appellate context versus the commission context. But I wouldn't disagree with your premise that the commission takes all comers, if I can put it that way.
Let me ask a question about switching stations and transmission lines. The Fauquier case, where I believe Dominion filed a request for a special use permit with regard to the switching station. Would that be indicative of the fact that even Dominion thought that the switching station was not a transmission line?
The timing there is important, Justice Powell, because the application for local zoning approval in the Fauquier case preceded the enactment of 46.1F. 46.1F was enacted by the General Assembly after that process had begun, and from that point forward, preempted by operation of law, local zoning of transmission lines. And so after the enactment of 46.1F, that's when the circuit court determined that that local zoning was preempted in that case. And, you know, one could argue that the enactment of 46.1F was in response to issues like those that had come up in Fauquier County at that time.
All right. If there's no further questions, Justice Powell, is that?
Yes, thank
all right. You. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dudley, I think I misspoke when I suggested that you had encroached on Mr. Reed's time. The truth is that we encroached on Mr. Reed's time, and I want to make that clear. And you get two extra minutes. You have 5 minutes and 13 seconds.
Thank you very much. Briefly on the motion to dismiss, I certainly concur with Justices McClanahan and Powell on all your arguments on that. I certainly agree. And going directly to your point, Chief Justice, regarding A6, I've reread that, and I think that the deemed appellant appellee language goes back to the language I was talking about under A2 that says everybody who is proceeding before the commission shall be parties. And then thereafter, and it specifically says, and parties who have not filed a notice of appeal, which we're one of those, who intend to participate shall file. We did that. And at that point, those parties who are already been parties deemed under A2 are now deemed to be an appellant or appellee. And I believe that Dominion's argument and the SEC's argument on this point cannot be squared with the language of 522, which supersedes all other rules. I'll go to the main case and the Fauquier case, since that seems to be the only authority. I would remind the court about the language that I think goes directly to the intent of the preemption in this court's case of Board of Supervisors of Fairfax County versus VEPCO, that says that the rule in the preemption was intended to have statewide control over transmission lines because they traverse several counties, and that doesn't happen here. In the Fauquier County case, Dominion likes and the SEC likes to argue that somehow the court got to that point. It did not. If you read the order, it doesn't say anything about zoning or preemption. And then when you look at the Commonwealth's attorney's memorandum to his clients, which was sort of a memorandum of futility. Dear clients, we've already lost before the circuit judge. We've lost in the SEC in the certificate process. Let's not file a lawsuit to stop the construction. Okay. But in that memo, he specifically says, I disagree that the zoning power issue, which he calls it, I disagree the zoning power issue was ruled upon. So even back then, the parties disagreed that that was actually ruled upon by the court, and I'm standing here today some 20, 30 years later saying we still disagree that it was ruled upon. In the main matter, completely different issue. There the issue was, does the main utility commission have power to review the electronics inside of a substation? Well, we don't question that. They certainly do. The question is whether or not this is a transmission line that's been preempted by the General Assembly, and that's completely a different issue. Let me respond to a couple of things that were said regarding that. For example, SEC counsel discussed the SEC's expert statement about it being agnostic. If you read that language really just goes to the fact that power has to flow through a switching station, which we certainly don't disagree that power does flow through switching stations. It flows through every electric utility facility under subsection A. The fact is, only a transmission line is a line that takes power over great distances from one place to another. A switching station does not do that. It reduces power from one level to another. It doesn't transmit power anywhere. Only a transmission line does that. Back to, in my remaining time, back to the error in granting that. If you look at 56-46.1b, it says, as a condition to approval, the commission shall, among other things, determine that the route the line is to follow will reasonably minimize adverse impact. We don't doubt that the commission actually used those words in their order. Our question is the fact that they did not independently evaluate that as a matter of law. And then secondly, in our assignment of error, our next assignment of error regarding the application of the evidence, believes that, their finding is contrary to the evidence. In our case, we presented national, world-known, renowned experts in impacts on historic things. These people have lived on the property. They have PhDs. They have been hired by Colonial Williamsburg, Preservation Virginia, to know what history is important and how it best gets preserved. Dominion, on the other hand, put forward three folks. One was a retired appraiser from Texas who'd never visited the property. In fact, hadn't been to Virginia. One was a right-of-way consultant from Wisconsin who didn't speak to a single historic expert, had not visited the properties, but instead reviewed the photo simulations. And lastly, Ms. Harper. Ms. Harper is a lifelong Dominion employee. That's her job. She does a very good job for Dominion. She has a fine arts degree from the College of William Mary, which is a wonderful institution I graduated from. But a fine arts degree doesn't qualify you. And now Dominion can say, well, 23 years of working for me qualifies for her, and we don't really disagree that she is minimally qualified. My question is whether or not her opinion matters when, in fact, it is clear from the evidence that there are severe adverse impacts that are not and cannot be mitigated over this open water. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your arguments. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.